loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm John Kiriakou, and I'm joined in studio by co-host Brian Becker. In this hour, we take a look at the breaking news of the day. First, U.S.-Russian relations are on the rocks, not just because of President Trump's foreign policy, but also because members of both parties on Capitol Hill are demanding that Trump walk back his public statements supporting an easing of tensions with Moscow and say publicly that the Russians interfered in the 2016 presidential election. Next, the British Press Association reported today that Metropolitan Police detectives have identified the alleged perpetrators of a poison attack against a Russian defector and his daughter. Media reports say that Sergei and Yulia Skripal were poisoned by, quote, several Russians, unquote. UK Security Minister Ben Wallace called the reports ill-informed and wild speculation. Then Israel's parliament, the Knesset, yesterday passed a highly controversial law that defines Israel as the national home of the Jewish people, says that only Jews have the right to self-determination, downgrades Arabic from an official language to a protected one, and promotes the establishment of new Jewish settlements in the occupied territories. Israel is virtually alone in the world in not guaranteeing equality for all of its citizens. And then a Spanish Supreme Court judge on Thursday dropped an extradition request for six politicians on charges of rebellion for their roles in promoting independence for Catalonia, including former President Carlos Puigdemont. The decision was a major setback for Spain's central government, which has sought to crack down on the region's secessionist movement. And finally, consumers should expect to pay higher prices for imported cars if President Trump's auto tariffs are enacted. Car sellers say they will pass on all the new costs to consumers. The prices of top-selling foreign cars could rise between $1,400 and $7,000. That's all coming up next on Loud and Clear. And now we turn to U.S.-Russian relations. Those relations are on the rocks, not just because of President Trump's overall foreign policy. It's also because members of both parties on Capitol Hill are demanding that Trump walk back his public statement supporting an easing of tensions with Moscow and say publicly that the Russians interfered in the 2016 presidential election. We're joined here in the studio by Dr. Jeremy Kuzmarov. He's an author and historian. Welcome.
Thanks. It's great to be here.
So we talk a lot on this show about U.S.-Russian relations and the role reversal that we've seen in American politics, where now it's the Democrats who are the hawks, the anti-Russia hawks, and it's the Republicans who appear to be the doves, in some cases, pretty openly pro-Russia. Is this just domestic U.S. politics, or is there some bigger foreign policy issue at play here?
Well, I think one issue is you do have to look at the funding. There are some business interests, you know, that lost out in Russia under the Putin regime that may be providing some financing to the Democratic Party. That could be one explanation. But I think a lot of it is partisan politics. And sadly, I think the Democrats have adopted, you know, conspiracy theories out of the 1950s. And it's not very flattering to the Democrats what they're trying to do now. And they're pushing a very regressive foreign policy agenda that I think genuine liberals should repudiate.
And we have to say, John, you called the Republicans dovish, but they're, it's a very, I don't know,
not
it
really.
Could be an insult to doves.
That's right.
They're doves with hawk's claws, yes. And maybe a hawk's beak, because it seems, while the genesis of this may be the Democrats trying to explain why they lost to the most unpopular candidate in American history, that would be Donald Trump, inexplicably defeated, it now seems to be both parties, because Trump, after the Helsinki summit, was condemned also by the Republican leadership, so much so that Trump, who normally never walks back from anything, tried to do a U-turn. Go ahead.
Well, I think we're seeing a kind of scary consensus building, yeah, for the reinvigoration of the Cold War. It's disturbing. I mean, I don't think, you know, these accusations are being levied against Russia without substance. For instance, Russia is constantly accused of being the aggressor in Ukraine. That's a highly debatable premise, but it's just accepted as fact by almost everybody. And it's kind of playing on maybe a latent Russophobia in the population and ignorance about Russia that's quite disturbing.
Yeah. And let's just go. I want to try to understand. We do this almost daily here, mm-hmm. Get the opinions of different people who have expertise on U.S. foreign policy or on U.S.-Russian relations. What's caused this sort of new Cold War? This hysteria where everybody has to say Russia is an adversary. It's not just like another country. I mean, a couple of years ago, Russia was a member of the G8. I mean, it had been included. It was the G7, then it became the G8. Obama and Hillary Clinton said they wanted to press the reset button and make relations better with Russia. President George W. Bush in 2001 said he actually looked into the eyes of Vladimir Putin. He could see his soul. These were friendly things. If somebody talks like that now, no, that would be a violation of the consensus. Why?
Well, I think the simplest explanation may simply be the need for a foreign enemy. I mean, the war on terror has lost its luster, is winding down. Bin Laden's long dead. Most Americans don't really support the endless perpetuation of the war in Afghanistan. They want the war on terror to end. The threat of terrorism has receded. So the military industries, as we know, are very powerful, very influential on Capitol Hill. And there's a need for a new enemy. So it's very easy to reinvoke the Cold War and reinvoke stereotypes about the Cold War. And you have a president of Russia who had been part of the KGB. So it makes it very easy to depict him as this evil ex-KGB officer. And it's easy to stir up the population in this way. And that could sustain the extraordinarily high defense spending that is a disgrace.
But there has to be some long-term consequence for this kind of a policy, no? I mean, eventually the Democrats are going to find themselves in the White House again, or eventually the Democrats are going to find themselves in control of one or both houses of Congress. And then this issue of foreign relations and relations with Russia are going to be the Democrats' problems. Well, they've been spending their time poisoning those relations. So over the long term, does this benefit the Democrats in any way, or is this just going to create more problems?
I don't think it benefits the American populace at all. It can be a political formula for diverting the public's attention away from the serious economic problems in the country and growth of class inequalities, which recent history has shown the Democrats don't really want to address those problems. The party is in the pocket of Wall Street and doesn't want to engage in or promote serious reform and tries to undercut the progressive wing of the party that is genuinely, I think, concerned about these issues of inequality. So in that respect, it's a political program the Democrats are pursuing, and I think they want to return to the days of the Cold War, and they'll divert the public's attention. They think the public can rally around defeating a renewed evil empire under Vladimir Putin.
We talk about, Brian and I talk about defense spending on this show a lot, and I can't help but to come to the conclusion that once the Democrats find themselves in a position of leadership again, we're really not going to see any kind of reform or cuts in defense spending.
Well, we'll see an increase.
I think we will.
It'll be an increase. You know, I want to go back to the issue of how this is resonating with the American public, which is obviously very polarized. And it's not the first time in U.S. history that the population has been polarized. We did have a civil war, in fact, and 650,000 people died in the Civil War. The bloodiest war the U.S. has ever fought was an internal civil war. But, I'm looking this morning at the media reports about how Trump's meeting with Putin went in Helsinki with the voters. The story that's grabbing headlines right now on CNN is 55% of Americans disapprove of Trump's summit. But then you look at 80% of Republicans actually thought the meeting was good. 80%. Those numbers actually aren't different from where Trump is in terms of overall approval rating. He has about a 45% support from the population. His position on Korea, by the way, his meeting with Kim Jong-un, that's the thing that's got the highest approval rating so far, 55% approval rating. In many ways, it would seem to me, while the political class, so to speak, however you want to characterize it, is going one way, average Americans actually might prefer peace as opposed to war with Russia. Crazy notion, right?
Well, and that's why I think the Democratic strategy could seriously backfire. I mean, they haven't really looked very good, I think. You know, the rhetoric they're adopting is quite extreme. They're adopting these conspiracy theories. It's making them look bad, I think, and a lot of people can see through it. So that's why in my book I call, the first Cold War is tragedy, the second is farce, because what we're seeing playing out is a farce that I think a lot of Americans do see through, and it's contributing to, declining legitimacy of the ruling class at large.
Let's just talk about where it ends. I mean, it's a dangerous time, obviously. The Pentagon, through the National Security Strategy announced in January, said major power confrontation is the priority for the U.S. military in the coming decade or decades. That would mean possible confrontation or war with Russia and China. That seems insane. I mean, both countries have like huge, vast arsenals of thermonuclear weapons, as does China. Could we actually end up in confrontation?
It's certainly possible. I mean, I think the United States at this time, you know, there is a lot of insecurity about the waning of American global hegemony and the fear that, the great fear would be that Russia and China, you know, band together and become ever more powerful and capable of challenging U.S. military power. But yeah, this new Cold War is heading in a very, very dangerous direction. If the SALT Treaty is not renewed, you know, that's an attempt to control the level of nuclear weapons. We'll see ever more nuclear weapons and a new nuclear arms race that could easily spiral out of control. There's these new nuclear tip weapons that have been developed that give the illusion that they won't be as dangerous. So, you know, somebody might be compelled to use that if confrontation increases. Yeah, and the rhetoric is getting a warlike rhetoric. We hear the language of appeasement being used. That could easily lead into a war footing. And we're already seeing that with the expansion of NATO on Russia's borders, more and more military exercise in Eastern Europe. And Russia rightfully feels encircled and is going to adopt its military policy accordingly. And yeah, these proxy wars, I mean, already in Syria, U.S. forces were in confrontation with Russian mercenaries. So we're already seeing direct confrontation there. So these things could escalate even further. So the prospects are very, very dangerous.
Those are important points, John. And when you think about it, the language, people, again, in the media saying Russian interference in the 2016 election was an assault. It's akin to the 9/11 attacks and Pearl Harbor. Well, after Pearl Harbor, the U.S. entered World War II. After 9/11, the U.S. started the war on terror. The actions and the actual concrete military initiatives flow from the political landscape in many, many cases. So hyperbolic language, yes, but nonetheless, it could have actual consequences.
It's very worrying. We're going to have to leave it there, though. We were joined here in the studio by Dr. Jeremy Kuzmarov. He's an author and historian. You're listening to Loud and Clear. Stay tuned. We'll be right back after a short break.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
The British Press Association reported today that Metropolitan Police detectives have identified the alleged perpetrators of a poison attack against a Russian defector and his daughter. Media reports say that Sergei and Yulia Skripal were poisoned by, quote, several Russians, unquote. UK Security Minister Ben Wallace called the reports ill-informed and wild speculation. We're joined from New Jersey by Daniel Lazar. He's a journalist and the author of three books, The Frozen Republic, The Velvet Coup, and America's Undeclared War. And we're joined from London by Alexander Mercouris. He's the editor-in-chief of The Duran. Welcome, both of you.
Thank you. Pleasure to be here.
Alexander, let's start with you. I tried to read everything that was published on this story today, and I could not get beyond, quote, several Russians, unquote. There are no names. There are no descriptors. There's no background, who these guys were, where they came from, how they did it. It's just that we're supposed to take the source's word for it, that it was several Russians. Are you hearing anything more than that?
I'm hearing absolutely nothing more than that. And you're absolutely right to express bafflement, because this is in some ways a good example of news which is non-news. To the best of my ability, the only thing I can piece together is that the British authorities, or at least perhaps the British authorities, because we've had this denial from the security minister, but the British authorities appear to have gone through all the CCTV footage of various people that look suspicious in Salisbury. And it's possible that they've linked two of these people that they've seen in Salisbury on the CCTV cameras to two individuals who left Britain on airplane and who perhaps traveled on aliases. And they seemed, on the basis of what are called mysteriously facial recognition techniques, I have no idea what that means. There's a view that they are possibly Russians, but there is no names attached to them. And we're hearing reports that nobody actually knows who they are. Now, if you can make any sense of that, I can't.
Yeah. And Daniel, has there been any indication at all that the U.S. is helping the British in this, that FBI, for example, is over there helping them investigate?
I'm not aware of any information along those lines, and I can't imagine how the U.S. really could help. I mean, do you really think the FBI would be of much help in these matters?
No, I think they're still looking for the guy who did the anthrax attack 18 years ago.
The information is very sketchy. We have no idea what to make of it, but it may be true. We have no idea. We can speculate in lots of interesting ways, but we have just no idea really what's happening, and so we'll see what turns up.
Well, this has been described, Novichok. Again, John, you and I are not experts. We're trying to follow the news.
No, but I know what you're going to say, and you took the words right out of my mouth.
Go ahead.
Go right ahead.
No, go ahead.
It's that this Novichok is supposed to be, first of all, it's death incarnate, right? It's the most deadly substance known to man. Nothing can survive it. It penetrates the spacesuits that people wear when they're working around it. It's the most horrible thing ever created. But it also evaporates very quickly. Well, we're supposed to believe now that this stuff has just been hanging around a public park outside, and weeks after the initial event, it poisoned these two other people and killed so far one of them.
Yeah.
That doesn't make any kind of scientific sense to me.
And again, for the audience, Skripal, the father, not Yulia Skripal, the daughter, they were both poisoned, but somehow, in spite
survived. Of survived.
They have survived.
Mm-hmm.
That he was a British double agent. He was in other words, he's a Russian who was working for British intelligence. He turned in a bunch of Russians. Russia arrested him. He was in prison for about 4 years, and then he was let go, and he was exchanged to the UK for a prisoner swap. Now he's an old guy. I mean, what would be the reason, Alexander, that Russia would carry out a public assassination of a guy they had let go and made his sentence one third of what it could have been? It just the whole and now they've recovered, and now we can't hear from them. They've been secreted away, so they can't tell their story. I mean, the whole thing stinks.
Let's take it first, step by step. First of all, I cannot see any conceivable motive for the Russians to want to kill Sergei Skripal. As you correctly said, they'd let him go and they'd pardoned him. Now, there has been some suggestions that this was done by Putin in order to terrify dissenters in Russia in the run-up to the elections, the presidential elections. I have to say that is complete and total nonsense. Anybody who knows about anything about the political situation in Russia knows that that theory just doesn't stand up and doesn't make any kind of sense. So we don't have a coherent or logical motive that would point to the Russian authorities. Maybe there are other people in Russia who might want Skripal killed, but the Russian authorities, very difficult to see. Secondly, turning to this question of the Novichok, and you're absolutely correct to say that the properties of this substance, which has been called Novichok, seem to change to fit the story. So that sometimes we're told, you know, that it vanishes very quickly, other times that it lingers for a long time, sometimes that it's incredibly deadly and kills people instantly, other times that it can be actually isn't so deadly after all. It changes, as I said, with the story. I personally think that the reason we are hearing these stories about these Russians who have been identified or perhaps not identified is partly because the British authorities are embarrassed by this information about this Novichok, which has turned up supposedly in the house of one of the two British victims in a perfume bottle that they allegedly picked up in a park. I mean, I find that so bizarre that I think an awful lot of people are saying, how does that make any sense? So possibly it looks to me that someone, in order to try and give the Russian side of the story a little bit more, shall we say, support, has come up with this suggestion that the perpetrators have been identified. Only it doesn't look as if they actually have been identified, and there doesn't seem to be much evidence that they're actually Russians, apart from these facial recognition techniques that none of us, at least I don't really understand what they are.
That's the voice of Alexander Makuris. We're also speaking with Daniel Lazar about the Novichok issue, the new iteration. Daniel, you know, when we were talking to people in the UK in the beginning, there was like a wave of hysteria against Russia. And then the story started to fall apart and it became kind of ridiculed. Gin distillery, Bristol Dry Gin, actually made a joke out of it. I guess it had become such a point of ridicule. They issued something called the Novichok edition of their gin. I'm looking at the, they, by the way, they apologized and took it back. It said 75% volume. And then I was seeing on Facebook people saying 75% volume, the Novichok edition of this gin, 85% effective. Again, a joke about whether this is actually that deadly. Nonetheless, by naming Russians, even if there's no names attached to the label Russians, sort of like the GRU indictments or these other indictments, once you can say, we know it's the Russians, we don't know if the Russians
are word for it.
We don't know if the Russians are pro-Putin, anti-Putin, whether they might have wanted to set up the Russian government, you know, because there's a lot of anti-Putin Russians in the UK as well. Anyway, what all you have to say, Daniel, right now in America or perhaps in the UK is we know who did it. The Russians did it. And that's a way of trying to get public opinion back on the side of those who are asserting that this was, in fact, the criminal acts of the Russian government.
Americans assume that Russian equals Putin. But, of course, that's not true. It's a country of 140 million, I think. I mean, I'm not even quite positive. And a lot of independent people running around and actually in some ways quite chaotic political conditions. So it's hard for me to believe that Putin ordered this hit, if it was indeed a hit, because it's so counterproductive. I mean, it's backfired so badly, it's causing no end of heartache. The guy is as smart as everybody thinks he is. He should have realized instantly that this would not be a profitable move. But it's possible that criminal elements, rogue intelligence agents, we have no idea, could be behind it. But that's all we know. There could be others. It could be Brits. It could be British intelligence. It could be porting down laboratories. I mean, we just don't know anything at this point. But I must say that I'm very skeptical that Putin would have done it because he just had so much to lose. It'd be so obviously counterproductive.
That's the thing, is John. We don't have the facts. But, you know, if you were, you know, like as we've discussed before, if you were an insurance company trying to investigate someone's death, you'd start with the question, who is the beneficiary? The last person to benefit would be Putin or the Russian government led by Putin.
There's no upside for Putin.
And this guy is such a non-entity within the world of intelligence that they let him go. They pardoned him. I mean, anyway, we're going to keep following this story. Maybe we'll find out who the, quote, Russians are,
yeah,
who British intelligence say did it.
I hope we do. We were joined from New Jersey by Daniel Lazar. Daniel's a journalist and the author of the books The Frozen Republic, The Velvet Coup, and America's Undeclared War. And we were joined from London by Alexander Mercouris, the editor-in-chief of The Duran. You're listening to Loud and Clear. We'll be right back after this.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
And clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
The Israeli Knesset, or parliament, yesterday passed a highly controversial law that defines Israel as the national home of the Jewish people. It says that only Jews have the right to self-determination. It downgrades Arabic from an official language to a, quote, protected one, unquote, and promotes the establishment of new Jewish settlements in the occupied territories. Israel is now virtually alone in the world in not guaranteeing equality for all of its citizens. We're joined from Chicago by Ali Abunima, the co-founder of the Electronic Intifada, and author of the book, The Battle for Justice in Palestine. Ali, good to talk to you.
Thank you.
Ali, tell us why the Israelis felt that this very strongly worded bill was necessary.
That's a good question, given that most of these racist provisions are already incorporated into Israeli law. What this law does is bring them all together and restate them, you could say, in a much more affirmative an in-your-face way, which creates a public relations problem for Israel, given its efforts to market itself as the only democracy in the Middle East, if not the only democracy in the galaxy. So why did they do it? I think the push for this law came from the most right-wing elements in Israel, and that's saying something given how right-wing their political system is in general. particularly from the Jewish Home Party led by Naftali Bennett. And those parties have the ultimate goal of annexing the West Bank completely, or at least the vast majority of the West Bank, to Israel, which would create what they view as a demographic problem or a demographic threat, because there would be too many non-Jews to maintain a Jewish supremacy at the ballot box. So this law allows Israel to state that, you know, no matter how many non-Jews there are in the country, even if there are a majority, this will always be a country for Jews only. And in that sense, people, legal advocates, are saying accurately, in my view, that this law violates the international prohibition of the crime of apartheid, because its goal is to maintain a regime of racial or ethnic superiority of one group over another. So it's accurate to call it an apartheid law.
Yeah, an explicit apartheid law.
It is. You know, I try actually to not throw that word around very often, but there's just no way to get around it. This is an apartheid law. It's one of the most racist laws, I think, anywhere in the world right now. There's just no other word to use to describe it.
And the unintended consequences of this sort of gross hubris and arrogance of the ultra-right and of the racists, and we see this everywhere, the unintended consequences, it actually takes the mask off and makes it that much more clear, so that you don't have to worry about throwing around the word apartheid, because it's so explicitly there. It is the law of the land now. Of course, internationally, a violation of all international law. And in addition to being illegal, immoral, unethical, disgusting at every turn, Ali, help the audience understand what the vote looked like in the Knesset. It was, I'm looking at ynetnews.com. It's described as a stormy session, and the vote was 62-55, I believe, if I'm not wrong. What about internal Israeli politics?
There's two aspects to this. One is that Netanyahu, the prime minister, supported the law, and he did that in order to... Initially, he hadn't, by the way. It was proving to be an international embarrassment for Israel, and he was trying to kick it into the long grass, as they say. But he came around to it. There were some amendments which, quote-unquote, softened some of the more blatantly racist aspects, not in a substantive way, because, again, as I mentioned, most of these racist provisions are already in Israeli law. But Netanyahu came around to backing it, and that's really to try to stop his support bleeding to the even further right. And so that's one aspect of the internal Israeli politics ahead of elections, which have to come, you know, next year at the latest. Then you had, in the Knesset, you had Palestinian citizens of Israel. There's 12 of them there. Palestinian citizens of Israel, they're about 1.5 million. Unlike Palestinians in the West Bank and Gaza, they do have the right to vote, although they are second-class citizens. They were tearing, you know, protesting. They tore up copies of the law, and they were thrown out of the Knesset. Just a couple of weeks ago, as this bill was being debated, one of the Arab parties in the Knesset put forward a bill simply calling for equality of all citizens of Israel, legal guarantees for equality, regardless of whether they're Jewish, Arab, Christian, Muslim, whatever else. In an unprecedented step, this had never happened before, one of those lawmakers told me, the Knesset speaker refused to even accept the bill. That's unprecedented, because in a democracy, lawmakers are supposed to be able to put forward any bill they want. It can be voted down, it can be dismissed at the committee stage, whatever. But you at least have the right to file your bill. The speaker did not even allow them to file a bill calling for equality of all citizens, something that people in any democracy are supposed to take as a fundamental basic principle.
It says so much about the word democracy.
It sure does.
Rule of the people. But of course, the United States has its own history on this, because we had a, quote, democracy, except for the enslaved parts of the population, which were very substantial. or Athenian democracy, which was built on the backs of enslaved people. I mean, always limited. But nonetheless, all that said, even on its face, this is the negation of democracy. And at the same time, we have the United States government funding this negation of democracy in the name of democracy, so much so that it's still the largest recipient of U.S. military and economic aid among all countries in the world. Let's just talk, if we can, Ali, about the demographics inside of Israel, you know, historic Palestine. I'm looking at some statistics here. 74% are Jews of all backgrounds, and that includes people of many different ethnicities. 20.9% are Arab of any religion other than Jewish.
That's only in, you know, Israel.
Exactly.
That doesn't include the West Bank and Gaza Strip. But you have to look at all these territories together, historic Palestine, which would be Israel, the West Bank, and Gaza together, because that's the territory Israel rules and has ruled for most of its history. You know, this fiction that Israel is somehow separate from the West Bank and Gaza, it's a total one-state solution, but it's an apartheid state solution. And what this bill does and other laws Israel passed recently is they extend the creeping legal annexation of the West Bank. So when you look at Israel within its pre-1967 boundaries, it's 74% Jewish or whatever the statistics you gave. But when you look at Israel, the West Bank, and Gaza together, the territory Israel really rules, Jews are now less than 50% of the population. And it's important to understand that. Why would they need a law? You know, let me put it this way. Throughout Israel's history, they had this Jewish, gerrymandered Jewish majority that came about through the expulsion of the Palestinians, where they could say, well, you know, Jewish supremacy within Israel is a democratic outcome of elections because there's simply more Jews. But once you have a reality where Jews are less than 50% in this single state, then the only way to maintain Jewish supremacy is to pass a constitutional law, which is what Israel did today, that says no matter how many or how few Jews are, Jews rule. And that's what this nation state bill or nation state law does. It enshrines in constitutional law that it's a constitutional principle that only Jews have self-determination within historic Palestine. Remember, the bill also contains another provision, which it says that Jewish settlement is, you know, a fundamental principle of the state, and that the state will encourage and consolidate Jewish settlement. But it places no geographical limits on that. So that includes Jewish settlement within Israel. That means displacing Bedouin communities in the Negev or displacing Palestinian citizens of Israel in the Galilee. But it also includes the West Bank and East Jerusalem. So this bill is a prelude to the creation of a one-state solution throughout historic Palestine, or including the West Bank or most of the West Bank, in which potentially a Jewish minority government rules and does so with a constitutionally declared mandate to do so.
Critically, critically important clarification from Ali Abu Nima, because we are now, as he's saying, and I think it's these are like the facts of this are just so, so important for people to understand. This is the replication of the South African model in an explicit way. And then the people of the world have to decide, are you going to be on the side of the racist apartheid regime? Would you be on the side of the South African racist apartheid regime? Or will you stand for people, for justice, for a one state where people have equality under the law? That's really quite simple. And that's why, John, BDS movement is going to grow. These are the unintended consequences of the hubris and arrogance of these extreme racist provisions.
Exactly right. We're out of time. We were joined from Chicago by Ali Abu Nima, the co-founder of the Electronic Intifada and author of the book, The Battle for Justice in Palestine. You're listening to Loud and Clear. We'll take a short break and come right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
A Spanish Supreme Court judge on Thursday dropped an extradition request for six politicians on charges of rebellion for their roles in promoting independence for Catalonia, including former President Carles Puigdemont. The decision was a major setback for Spain's central government, which has sought to crack down on the region's secessionist movement. We're joined from Barcelona by Dick Nichols. He's the correspondent for Spain and Catalonia for Green Left Weekly. Dick, it's been a long time. Welcome back.
Nice to be here.
I guess the obvious question is this over now?
It's not over yet, but it's another major step backwards in the long retreat of the Spanish legal system in the face of disagreement from its European partners or the European legal, you know, other European states, legal system, the other European legal systems in Belgium, Germany, and probably in Scotland, though had not yet come to court, don't see rebellion or sedition or even in some cases misuse of public monies involved in the referendum of October 1 last year. So that they have refused extradition to Spain on the basis of those charges. That is to say, they have declined euro warrants on the basis of those charges, with the exception of misuse of public funds in the case of Carles Puigdemont. And the Supreme Court judge, Pablo Llarena, has thrown up his hands and said, well, if few people aren't going to collaborate, then I'm going to withdraw the charges. The charges are not withdrawn within Spain, of course. What this means is that the exiles in outer can travel anywhere in Europe and do what they want, but they still face, they, if they step back into Spain, they would still face the charges, as, of course, do the imprisoned Catalan leaders, of which there are nine in jail at the moment.
And let's just bring people up to speed about them, because once things are not in the headlines, especially over here, people won't remember. Who are the nine? How long are they in prison for?
Well, they're in prison on preventive detention. They've not been charged. They're just about to be charged, or they've just been charged, but they have not. They've had bail requests, even large with large amounts of money offered, refused, ostensibly on the grounds that they would there was risk of flight. So the Supreme Court has got them in jail until the court, until the actual trial takes place, and we're talking about ministers. Seven ministers, including the vice president Oriol Junqueras in the previous Catalan government, and the two leaders of the major Catalan mass organisations, the Catalan National Congress and Òmnium Cultural, who've been in jail now for 8 months, simply on preventive detention.
I was struck by the anger that the Spanish central government reacted, especially to the German court, when the Germans said that they weren't going to extradite. It was as though we were listening to a petulant child, frankly, who was angry because the neighbor boy wouldn't give him back his ball. And that's really what this has come down to, at least in the papers, it seems that's what it's come down to.
I think petulance is too light. basically, what you've got is the reaction of the Spanish legal system was the part of the Spanish institutional structures that was least changed after the end of the Franco dictatorship. And basically what happened is a lot of judges who were judges in the Franco years passed on into the, quotes, democratic system, but without changing mentality. And this is where you find the most conservative, dare I say, reactionary parts of the Spanish state. And this is what the previous Spanish government was relying on to do its political work. It didn't want to negotiate with Catalonia in a Scottish-style referendum. Didn't want to negotiate about anything, in fact. And so it simply passed this work to the legal system and said, you charge these people. And so they did that. And now what you've had is this whole series of charges, I won't go into the details, which have, one after the other, been revealed to be have no content by other European courts, where the Spanish courts have attempted to get the exiled Catalan politicians, the ones who are not in jail, the ones who are in other European countries, extradited back to Spain. So what you have is a growing contradiction between the way the legal systems in the rest of Europe see what happened in Catalonia around the referendum of October 1 last year and how it's seen in Spain. And this contradiction will get bigger and bigger. And the new Socialist Party government, which listeners may remember, came in about a month ago when finally a majority voted out the previous People's Party, the Conservative Party government, they are now in a very tricky situation because they can pretend that there is, independence of the judiciary, division of powers, which is, of course, a farce here because the judiciary was used by the PP government to carry out its political work against the Catalan movement. Or they can do things like pretend they can actually instruct the new prosecutor general to drop the charges. And they're treading a tightrope between wanting to maintain the fiction of the independence of the judiciary, but wanting to be nicer to Catalonia and present an image of collaboration. There's already been meetings between the new Catalan president and the new Spanish president, which all with a lot of atmosphere about dialogue and getting back to political solutions to political problems. So this is all very, very complicated for the Spanish government.
That's the voice of Dick Nichols. He's a correspondent. We're talking to him from Barcelona. He's with the Green Left Weekly. A lot of people don't understand the role of fascism in Spain and the role of Franco.
And how long it lasted.
How long it lasted. And the other thing is that before World War II, almost all of continental Europe was led by fascist governments. That's on the eve of the war. Spain, the Franco government, remained intact after the war. All the other fascist governments in continental Europe were gone after World War II as a result of their defeat, but not so in Spain. And I'm looking, Dick Nichols, at a BBC story from Monday. Spain's far right protest against moving Franco's remains is the headline. And it's a picture of a demonstration that took place on Sunday, this last Sunday, of fascists in Spain, and they're giving the fascist Nazi-like salute. And again, Franco's tomb is there. It's not like Hitler. It's not like Mussolini. Franco's a big part of the legacy of Spain. And as you're saying, because the Spanish fascist state was never actually fully purged, it lives on. It lives on even though it has the imprimatur of democracy.
Well, why that demonstration took place is because the Socialist Party government, which is looking for areas in which it can actually introduce policies that were different to the PP and which will be progressive policies, has decided that Franco is going to be removed from his tomb in this obscene megalith called the Valley of the Fallen. The Valley of the Fallen is tombs of Franco, tomb of José Antonio de Rivera, who was the founder of the Falange, plus 25,000 corpses, the Republicans, and stuck there without the support of the okay of their families, and nationalists and Francoists. So it's this obscene thing, which has become a pilgrimage spot for the extreme right forces. And those are the ones you saw on Sunday. I mean, this is the real extreme right. This is people were there not only singing, Cara al Sol, a Francoist and national anthem, they were waving pre-democratic flags from the dictatorship period. And basically we had about 4,000 people there. And this gives you an intimation of that this current is still there. But it has been provoked by what will be the majority sentiment, the majority support will be to get rid of this thing, blow it up. But it will, you will see the strength of residual Francoism when the Socialist Party government moves to do that, because they'll use the courts, they'll make appeals of all sorts, they'll do demonstrations. But in the end, that will all help the Socialist Party government, because it will give them the impression. The impression will be that they stand for, modernism, they stand for Spain becoming a, quote, normal European country. That's very important for them, of course, in their contest with Unidos Podemos for hegemony over the whole of the left. So this is easy for them to do, and if there's more and more far-right resistance to it, that makes them look good.
That's the voice of Dick Nichols. Last of 45 seconds, Dick, I had a friend who traveled to where you are, to Barcelona, just in the last couple of weeks, and she told me that all of the iconography, the flags, all the symbolism that she was seeing maybe not all, maybe that's too much, but almost all was supporters of Catalan independence or Catalan self-determination. Is that accurate? And what's the mood? Anyway, 40 seconds left.
Okay, now the mood here is, well, to go by something a bit more scientific than the mood, the latest poll that you could trust still gives a majority to pro-independence forces in the Catalan Parliament, and if not, and probably a slightly larger majority, possibly a slightly larger majority. The mood from the people I talk to is, well, everything's quiet at the moment, but we're determined to push ahead. The reason we're in a sort of phony war at the moment is because of negotiations between the Catalan government and the Spanish government over the key question, can we have a Scottish-style referendum? In the end, the Spanish government will refuse that, even though it is trying to be nice and make progress in other areas in terms of Catalan autonomy and Catalan rights of administration of things in Catalonia.
We're going to have to keep following that story in our next segment, John.
Yeah, that was the voice of Dick Nichols, the correspondent for Spain and Catalonia for Green Left Weekly. He joined us from Barcelona. You're listening to Loud and Clear. Stay tuned. We'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
Consumers should expect to pay higher prices for imported cars if President Trump's auto tariffs are enacted. Car sellers say that they will pass on all new costs to consumers. The prices of top-selling foreign cars could rise between $1,400 and $7,000. We're joined from California by Dr. Jack Rasmus. He's a professor of economics at St. Mary's College of California and author of Central Bankers at the End of Their Ropes, Monetary Policy and the Coming Depression. He's also the author of an article in the World Review of Political Economy entitled Trump's Deja Vu China Trade War. Jack, welcome back.
My pleasure.
So, Jack, tell us about these tariffs, when or even if they'll be enacted, and if they are, how long will it take until consumers feel the bite?
Well, right now it's all just talk, mm-hmm. of course, and it's an announcement of an intent to impose tariffs, particularly on autos, before he goes to Europe and starts negotiating with the European Union over the question of trade and tariffs. So it's all talk. You know, you got to distinguish between political rhetoric here before the election and actual announcement of specific tariffs and then the actual implementation of the tariffs. You know, you don't have a trade war till you have actual tariffs being implemented. And if you look at, what the record in that regard so far is, as far as Trump's trade offensive is concerned, it's really quite minimal. Trump has actually implemented only $72 billion out of $3 trillion of U.S. imports. So 2.3% tariffs, total goods are tariffed. And the other side, whether it's the EU or China or the NAFTA countries, the same thing. They've responded with 2.3% tariffs on 2.3% of U.S. exports to the country. So it's largely smoke and mirrors so far. And of course, the markets know that, and they're not too upset about it. You know, the media is really hyping it all. And it doesn't mean that there won't be a trade war, but there certainly isn't one now. It's a lot of maneuvering, a lot of talk, and very minimal tariffs by both sides. Of course, if they do implement, if Trump does implement tariffs on U.S. autos, then it will raise prices because there's no such thing as a U.S. auto industry. You see, most of these auto parts, we're talking about auto parts mostly, come from other countries. And they're just assembled here in the United States. We have an auto assembly business industry in the U.S., but we don't have a made in America auto industry. And that's why the auto companies are kind of upset with his talk about tariffs on auto parts coming into the United States.
We're talking with Jack Rasmus. I don't have the numbers in front of me. I was just looking for them, but I read them early this morning. There's something like 147 million cars that are imported into the United States from overseas annually. There's about 150 million dollars worth of auto parts that are imported from overseas. And then there's something like 50 million trucks that are imported from overseas. But when you come to the car parts part of this equation, a Toyota, which makes a lot of cars in the United States, about 70% of the auto parts for Toyota come from overseas. So a Toyota car made in the United States, but using car parts that were which were imported from overseas, perhaps from Japan or elsewhere, that means the cost of those cars will go up if the price of the auto parts is jacked up by whatever, 20%, 15%. It's such an integrated world economy that it's that's the thing. Like tariffs and the protection of native industries, which were such a hallmark of the development of the United States or any developing economy in the face of stronger economies, it seems at this stage in history, 2018, that it's from a bygone era. Anyway, what's your take?
If you look back to the Reagan period, the biggest auto parts manufacturer in the United States was Delphi Communication. It had over 20 factories, over 100,000 workers. Every one of those factories and every one of those workers moved to Mexico. Delphi is one of the biggest manufacturers in Mexico. The auto parts industry that feeds, the GMs and the Fords and the Chryslers and so forth. Well, Chrysler's a foreign-owned company now. You know, it's all imports, mostly from Mexico for U.S. companies. There will be a deal with NAFTA before the election, I predict. They were very close, to the U.S. And Mexico, to a deal, but Trump stepped in a few months ago and blew it up because he doesn't want a deal unless it's close to the November elections. They're very close to an agreement on NAFTA, and most of the auto part imports will come from Mexico and Canada. And, this thing will all pretty much go away as far as the auto tariff threats are concerned. Of course, there won't be any conclusion of negotiations with the EU for quite some time because there's no way you conclude a deal until the effects of Brexit are well known, both for the UK and for the EU. And China negotiations are kind of stalled on purpose. China's waiting to see what happens with the NAFTA negotiations in the U.S. And also the U.S. trade team, negotiating team, can't get its act together. There's three different factions, and China's waiting to see which faction prevails. So a lot of this is domestic U.S. politics and a lot of hyperbole by Trump. And I think a lot of it's going to go away, particularly with NAFTA first, as we get to the election or soon after. And then next will be a deal with China, I believe. And further down the road will be Europe. So all this talk about the tariffs on European German cars and so forth is just maneuvering. It's just tactical negotiation maneuvering right now.
That's Jack Rasmus talking to us about the tariffs. I think Jack's right. I'm looking at the Wall Street Journal right now. Wilbur Ross, Commerce Secretary, billionaire, quote, too early to say, close quote, whether national security probe will bring auto tariffs. I mean, on one part of this, it's kind of laughable, John, that the U.S. may put tariffs on autos as part of a national security measure, as if.
Right, because that's going to help our national security.
And it's just such a laughable way to get around any other review process. But let me read, Jack Rasmus, to you a couple of words from a Commerce Secretary Wilbur Ross said Thursday that it's, quote, too early, close quote, to say whether the Trump administration will move ahead with proposed tariffs of up to 25% on imported vehicles and auto parts. Speaking ahead of a hearing in Washington, Mr. Ross said the government is still analyzing whether it will impose tariffs on national security grounds following a similar move on metals that would be aluminum and steel imported earlier this year. Quote, it's obvious by the attendance here this morning how vital this industry is to the United States and the global economy, Mr. Ross said. So, it could be all smoke and mirrors, so much headlines, and then who knows where it will be. But Jack Rasmus, explained for our audience here in Washington, D.C. and in stations around the country Who are the three factions inside the Trump administration? We have about 2 minutes left.
Yeah, well, it's very clear. Negotiations with China that have occurred so far, there's three factions in the U.S. The one is the big bankers and the multinational corporations. What they want out of China is more access to their market, more penetration, the ability to have 51% or 100% ownership of their operations in China. Heretofore, it was only 49%. China's already conceded that, has already given them that. That's why Mnuchin, Steve Mnuchin, Treasury Secretary, who's been leading negotiations, comes back from China in their last visit a couple of months ago and says, hey, we got a great deal. And then, of course, he kind of backed off because Trump doesn't want to conclude any deal right now. The second faction is Midwest agriculture. They want the Chinese to buy more agricultural goods from the U.S., which is the U.S. number one export. China has signaled, yeah, we'll buy hundreds of billions more from you guys. We will do that. So that faction is happy about what's going on. But the third faction in the U.S. is not so happy. That's the defense establishment, intelligence agencies, and so forth. They're quite concerned about China's 2025 program, which is by 2025, the China wants to be the leader in next-gen technology, which has to do with 5G and artificial intelligence, cybersecurity. They're concerned about the military implications of that leadership, and that's why they want restrictions on purchases, Chinese purchases of U.S. companies, and Chinese rules of tech transfer for companies doing business in China. They want that reduced and slowed. That's the toughest nut, and China's not agreeing to that. So two of the three factions will get what they want from China. The third faction won't. And the question is, will Trump settle for two out of three? I think he probably will with some token features, measures with regard to tech transfer that won't mean very much. So I think there'll be a deal with China, but not until after the elections. NAFTA before the elections, or right after the elections, NAFTA deal, it's almost there now. And Europe will be on much longer because they're waiting on what happens with Brexit.
It's so important what Jack Rasmus is doing because, again, there's so much hoopla and so much partisan politics playing out in the media on the question of the so-called trade war that people don't really actually understand it. And I think, John, the other point that he's making, sort of resonating what we talked about 2 weeks ago, the Defense Department, meaning mm-hmm. the Pentagon, mm-hmm. and their own intervention. We saw what James Mattis said when he spoke before the Naval War College graduates. He went at China big time about One Belt, One Road. It wasn't really about wars. It was about economic issues, but nonetheless, very, very important for the Pentagon.
That is right. We were joined from California by Dr. Jack Rasmus, a professor of economics at St. Mary's College of California and author of Central Bankers at the End of Their Ropes, Monetary Policy and the Coming Depression. You've been listening to Loud and Clear. We are completely out of time. Be sure to go to our Facebook page, Loud and Clear with Brian Becker, for daily updates. If you enjoy the show and want your friends to hear it, let us know by liking the page on Facebook. And you can also follow us on Twitter at Loud Clear Radio. You can hear us every day, Monday through Friday from 4 to 6 p.m. on 105.5 FM and 1390 AM in the Washington, D.C. area. You can also hear us at SputnikNews.com and as a podcast at iTunes and at iHeartRadio. Remember, telling the truth is important, but to make a difference, it has to be loud and clear. We'll see you next time.
Loud and Clear.